friends of Jesus Christ, even though we have just a few verses about Absalom, I'd like to take us more or less through the story that begins already in chapter 13. But before I do that, I want to tell you a quote that I came across from Robert De Niro, the actor. He said, "The joy of being an actor was that you could live different lives without risking real life consequences." And of course, in the real world, you cannot not risk the consequences of what you say or do. We're saddled with them. They're part of us and the people around us. And I suspect that there are things that you've said that you wished you could unsay and do that you could undo, and that there were decisions you made that you wish you could remake. I mean, some of the saddest things that you and I say sometimes is, "Oh, if only, you know, if only I hadn't done that," or "if only I had done that or said that, if only." I mean, part of the dignity, part of the weight of being a human being is that our actions and our words have consequences and that we are accountable for them. Now, David, I suspect, wished that he had never laid eyes on Bathsheba or asked for her name. But he commits adultery and he arranges for Uriah's death, Bathsheba's husband. And then, as you remember from last week, the prophet Nathan comes and says, "David, the sword will not leave your family. You have brought such trouble upon yourself and your children." And then, that's chapter 12. Then in chapter 13, it begins. That chapter is about Tamar. Tamar, David's beautiful daughter. And one of David's sons, Amnon, has the hots for her. And he schemes and plots till he rapes her. Now, Tamar has a brother, a half-brother to Amnon, Absalom. And Absalom is so angry that he schemes and plans, and in 2 years lays something in place that he kills Amnon. Now, Absalom, after killing his half-brother, flees, and he lives in exile for 3 years, till finally David is persuaded to call him out of exile. So Absalom comes back to the city of Jerusalem, but for 2 years, David will not allow Absalom in his presence. Eugene Peterson, who has a book about David, says that the hard-heartedness of David in this scene may well have been the downfall of his relationship with Absalom. Anyway, Absalom then convinces Joab, the general, to persuade David to let him see him. And so Joab persuades the king, and David meets with Absalom and kisses him. But the damage has been done. Now, in chapter 15, after this kiss from his father, Absalom begins his scheming to take the throne away from David. Now, I've got two things about Absalom. There are two things that you should just remember. He is extremely beautiful. He is such a handsome man. It's the funniest thing, really, when you think about it. Here in the Scriptures, in chapter 14, verse 25, it says that there was no one in all of Israel to be praised for his beauty as much as Absalom. And on top of that, he had a head of hair that was the envy of everyone. It's reported, now listen to this, I don't think we would put this in, but it's reported that once a year Absalom would have his hair cut, and the trimmings alone tipped the scales at 3.5 pounds. Commentators say it proved his vigor, his virility. So he was not only handsome, he was a stud. Right? I mean, he is beautiful. He's too beautiful for his own good. You know, Frederick Buechner says somewhere, about his mother, that his mother was very beautiful. And he says, because she was so beautiful, she didn't have to be nice to have people nice to her. I think that's true, not just of beauty, but of really smart people, of really powerful people, of really rich people. They have so much that they don't have to be nice. People will suck up to them all the time. David's son, Absalom, was very beautiful. Too beautiful. People just gravitated towards the man. Here's another thing. Absalom was also very enormously ambitious. He wanted David's throne. And he was next in line. After Amnon was gone, he was next in line. But you know, just think Prince Charles. Some people don't give up their throne very easily. And he thought, you know, this David could live to be a very old man and remain on the throne, and I won't have a chance to be a king. And then there was the fact that David, I don't remember where I read this anymore, but he had something like 19 sons because of all those wives and concubines. And so Absalom was not sure who in the end would land on the throne. And so he takes matters into his own hand. And then in chapter 15, we're told that he gets this chariot and an entourage of 50 men, and he goes up and down the kingdom, telling people what he would do if he were king. And then there's this verse, and Absalom stole the hearts of the people. He stole the hearts of the people. He had them in his hand. And so after 4 years of that, and signs coming up with Absalom and down with David, Absalom thinks it's time. And he sounds a trumpet, and people gather from all over Israel behind Absalom, and they begin marching towards Jerusalem. When David hears that an army has been gathered around Absalom towards Jerusalem, he gathers his faithful and flees into the wilderness, where he spent a great deal of time running away from Saul. He does, and this is all in chapter 16 and 17, he plans a few spies to undercut Absalom's decisions. But he leaves, Absalom comes into the city, and one of the first things he does, at the advice of one of his advisors, is he pitches a tent on the roof of the palace, and he has sex with David's concubines. To show who's ruling the roost, I think. When you read it, you're thinking, this is so barbaric. This is so messy. Talk about dysfunctional families. We have nothing over David. This is awful. It is so ugly. It is so gross. So barbaric. And then I was thinking, and out of this clan comes the Savior of the world? You've got to be. It's so messy. It is so messy, this story. Then what happens, and now we're practically in chapter 18. Absalom has gathered a huge army, and David has gotten his men together, and they are to meet for battle. And David wants to go with them, but his men persuade him not to go into battle because they say, David, you are worth more than 10,000 of us. So then, as they're about to leave, there's this word. David calls, as commander-in-chief, he calls his commanders Joab, Abishai, and Ittai, and he says to them, deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom. Now, this introduces what I think is a theme that runs through the next couple of chapters, and that is the tension between the demands of justice and the longings for mercy. Justice and mercy. Here is a request for mercy. David asks that they deal gently with the man, with the young man, for his sake. Now, it is like a jewel in a messy muck. After you've been reading all this dirty stuff, here comes this most generous appeal to show gentleness to the rebel. It's thought that the writer wants us at this point to remember how King Saul responded to his son Jonathan when Jonathan said more or less that he was on David's side. You remember? Saul gets so angry that he takes his spear and heaves it at his son, hoping, I think, to spear Jonathan to the wall. David is a different kind of man. Again, Eugene Peterson, who wrote this book on David, says that this is such a remarkable expression of forgiveness, of gentleness. It is a magnificent thing. And Peterson thinks that it is the wilderness that has restored to David a compassion for human frailty. Be gentle for my sake with the young man Absalom. Now, just quickly, two things. First of all, he does not identify Absalom as his son. It's as if he's reticent, as if he's kind of reluctant to draw on that connection. But he does say, do it not for Absalom's sake, but for my sake. For my sake. We have a long history. You know me. You know me. For my sake. Be gentle with the young man, Absalom. One other commentator that I read, Brueggemann, Walter Brueggemann, who has a really fine commentary on this whole book, he says that he thinks that perhaps, you know, David says that in all of the people, what does it say? And the king gave orders, and the people heard it, that the people were moved with pathos, they were moved. And I thought, well, maybe, but maybe not. I mean, maybe they were thinking when they heard David say, be gentle with the young man, maybe they were thinking, but it's that young man who is bringing my son into danger and my husband. It is that SOB that is bringing all of this on our heads. He's making us fight some of our kin who've taken the other side. He's bringing tremendous misery upon us, and you want us to be gentle with the young man. The Duke of Wellington, I read this. Anyway, he said that if you've seen one day of war, you will pray to God that he'll never let you see another day of such sadness and such horrors. And if that's true of international wars, you can imagine how awful it is with civil war. Civil wars are anything but civil. We've seen them in Rwanda. We've seen it in Bosnia. We're seeing it unfold in Iraq. We've seen it in our own nation. Fathers against sons and friends of long standing taking up swords against one another. It is simply awful. And Solomon is the cause of it. He has called this mess into being, and he is not repenting. And you want us to deal gently with him. Give me 5 minutes with this son of a gun. You hear that, right? Does he deserve gentleness? Anyway, David then makes the appeal for mercy. And then the army goes off. And then in verse 6, they went into the field against Israel. And the battle was fought in the forest of Ephraim. And the men of Israel were defeated there by the servants of David. And the slaughter there was great on that day, 20,000 men. It's the killing fields. And then it's as if this were a movie. You know, first there's this sort of panoramic shot of the battle, and then it zeroes in. The camera focuses in on one individual, and it's Absalom. Verse 9, Absalom happens to meet the servants of David. He's riding on his mule, and he's now running, I imagine, and the mule went under the thick branches of a great oak, and his head caught fast in the oak, and he was left hanging between heaven and earth, with the mule that was under him. And the mule went on. And then 10 young men, Joab's armor bearers, surrounded Absalom and struck him and killed him. A couple of things. First of all, it's the irony that the very thing of which Absalom was no doubt proud, his head of hair, was in fact his Achilles heel. It undid him. It resulted in him being caught in the branches of a tree. And then the writer says he was hanging there between heaven and earth. And Brueggemann says that's not just a physical description, but there's more in that little phrase, there hanging between heaven and earth. There is one who is not alive because he is so vulnerable and yet not dead. There is the rebel and the king's son. There is the sentence of justice and the longing for mercy. There is this terrible tension. He's hanging there between heaven and earth. Now, what's not in our passage here, we're told that a certain man comes upon Absalom. He sees him. He remembers David's request. And so he runs to Joab to say he has found Absalom. And Joab says, "Why didn't you kill the guy?" And the man says, "I couldn't. You know what David said." Joab becomes frustrated with the man, and he goes there, and he takes three spears or darts and pierces the heart of Absalom. And then a kind of frenzy sets in. Because then the 10 young men, verse 15, the 10 young men, Joab's armor bearers, surround Absalom and struck him and killed him. And then, again, this is not in the passage, what we've got. They take his body and they heave it. They heave it into a pit and they cover it with stones. No state funeral for this rebel. You see, for Joab, there was no question that this rebel deserved justice. And justice demanded that he be put to death, that he needed to die. Here was a rebel who was rising up against the God's anointed. And in any kingdom, you cannot allow for two conflicting kings. This one had to go, and Joab stabs him three times in the heart. Then what follows is there are two people. Joab has the trumpet blown, the men gather, and everybody, the enemy, the men of Israel, go back to their tents. And Joab then, there are two men who want to report the news to David. And one is a family friend, Ahimaaz. He's eager to go and tell David that there's been a deliverance. But Joab says, "You know, this is not clean. There's some bad news here. I don't want you to go and tell it to the king." And so Joab picks a Cushite, a foreigner, and he says, "You go and tell the king about the results of the battle." But Ahimaaz is, you know, he's wanting to tell this. And so finally, Joab relents. And because Ahimaaz is a very fast runner, he gets to David before the Cushite. And he reports that there's been a great victory. But David, he is so fixed on his son's future, says, "And what about the young man Absalom?" And then Ahimaaz, I don't know whether he doesn't have the heart or the courage, he can't get it to say it. And so he says, "Well, when Joab told me to go, I saw this tumult, but I didn't want to go and find out because I wanted you to know that we'd been delivered." And then the king says, "Well, you go to the side because another runner is coming." And the Cushite comes. And then David says, the young man says, "Well, we got here. Good tidings from my lord the king. For the Lord has vindicated you this day, delivering you from the power of all who rose up against you." And then again, the king, only one thing in mind, his son, says to the Cushite, "Is it well with the young man Absalom?" And the Cushite, who's thinking only of justice, says, "May the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise up to do you harm be like that young man." And then we're told that the king was deeply moved. I would imagine that the words of the Cushite stabbed David's heart the way the spears had stabbed Absalom's heart. I mean, when he begins to cry, "My son, oh Absalom, my son, my son," I mean, it is the cry of a heart that feels the physical pain of grief, of sadness. That there is such a gut-wrenching thing that it has moved every generation that reads it. And now and again, you have people that can identify with it. I mean, you know, you think of the times when something so sad happened that your innards are just torn to shreds. And I was thinking, you know, this week I was reminding myself of when my father was 47, died. And us six kids and my mom, we went to the funeral. And then after the service, we were allowed, they raised the casket. And you know, we're gathered around seeing my dad for the last time. And then the mortician closed that lid. And when that happened, my mother let out a howl of grief that is so and was so haunting. I mean, it was so pain-filled. Grief, the grief that you can feel when someone you love or want to be with is gone. I mean, and David, as he cries out over Absalom, my son, I mean, all of the missed opportunities, all the unfinished things, all of that was now never to be finished, was never to be said. It was just so awful. Death can be so awful. It cuts you to shreds when the ones you love are torn away from you. And here's another... Such a fascinating thing. It says, and he went up to the chamber over the gate. So Nick Waltersdorf, in his book on Lament for a Son, says that there is something about sorrow that is isolating. Because, he says, sometimes when you feel the pain, the other person doesn't quite have the same intensity, and you're never quite on the same page, and you feel so alone, and no one can really feel the pain that you feel. I mean, I have that, you know. I've had it where I go and visit someone, and I'm jabbering away, and all of a sudden I see them grimace, and I say, "Are you in pain?" And they say, "Oh, yes." Oh, I said, "Oh, I'm so sorry." But, you know, people can be sitting right next to you, and you don't know the agony or the horrors that they're going, or the feelings that there's a loneliness in sorrow. And so David goes and he goes into this room, and he cries out, "Oh, my son Absalom, my son, would I had died instead of you. Oh, Absalom, my son." David had so longed for mercy. And instead, justice reigned. And you know, when I was thinking about that, and I thought, well, what if mercy had a chance? Suppose this, I thought. Suppose this. Suppose when the battle was raging and it was clear that David's war-hardened soldiers were winning, that Absalom had come to his senses. And he thought, "Oh my, what am I doing? I will go back to my father's house. And I will say, I am not worthy to be the successor to your throne, but please make me a servant in your palace." And suppose he had surrendered, and 10 good men had taken him, and they had been... They're on their way to where David is. And then suppose we said, and David sees Absalom coming from afar. And David gets up and he runs to meet him, and he throws his arms around him, and he says to his servants, "Give the boy sandals and put a ring on his finger and give him a robe and kill the fatted calf, because this boy of mine was dead and now he is alive again." I imagined that, and as I imagined it, I thought those 20,000 dead bodies as one man would rise up and say, "That's not fair. That is not fair. That man has caused such misery to us. You cannot simply reintroduce him into the family. It's not fair. It simply is not fair." And it is Joab who tells David that he has got to get over this. And that's in chapter 19. It's really quite remarkable. The chapter opens with the men coming back from the battle, victorious, and then they hear the cries of David, and so they sneak off as though they were losers. And so Joab becomes so upset with this king of his. And he goes to the chamber where the king is, and he says, "You would have been happy if all of us had died and your enemies had lived. You've got to get a grip on yourself. Get off the couch, blow your nose, get into the balcony and wave to your brave soldiers and hand out some of the medals that some of them deserve. Because if you don't do something, this kingdom will be worse to you than it was when Absalom was still around." And so David is persuaded. He gets up. He thanks the soldiers. But deep down, David cries for his son, for he had longed so to make things better between himself and Absalom. You know, sometimes when you read the scriptures, you're often asked, sort of, this is a way of reading the scriptures, to put yourself in the place of the characters. And I was thinking, well, who would we identify with? Would it be with David or with Joab or with the soldiers or with the Cushite? You know who, if you were to ask the New Testament, they would undoubtedly identify you and me with Absalom. They would see us as the rebels, right? We're the rebels. I mean, I can confess that I'm a rebel. My heart is vain. I'm constantly thinking about myself, wondering how it's going. Constantly wanting to have it my way. I mean, are you any different? Are we not rebels? Should not your hearts be open to God? And all too often, it is your voice and your desires. God, He's on the fringes, if there at all. I mean, we are the rebels. And the angels would sing when we died and say, one more rebel bites to dust. We are Absalom. We're Absalom. And God, God is David. And just as David longed to be reconciled to his son Absalom, so God longs to be reconciled to you and me. There is this longing in the heart of God. That's the theme of the whole scripture. There's this longing in the heart of God to have those who were made in His likeness, that they be coming and sit in His family at His table. I mean, that is the longing of the heart of God. It is our, you know, theologians talk about an alien dignity. Whether you believe this stuff or not, you have the dignity of being one who is touched by the longing of God's heart. You are longed for. But the question that the New Testament so wrestles with is, how can a holy, righteous God be reconciled to the rebels without either condoning the sin or compromising His holiness? How can this universe not be torn apart if sin is somehow allowed into the presence of God? I mean, that's the question. This tension between justice, what is deserved, the mess that we humans have made of His creation, the things that spoil this creation. I mean, you can say it's everybody else but not me, but we're all implicated. We are the rebels. We are the rebels, you see? And how can God be reconciled to rebels? How can a king allow someone into His kingdom whose heart is set on displacing the true king? You see, and then you get the words that David spoke, words greater than he imagined when he says, oh, if only I could have died for my son, instead of my son. And the fulfillment of that longing comes to fruition 1,000 years later when God's son, someone greater than David, dies the death that rebels should have died. It is because Christ dealt with the issue of justice that He can deal gently with us sinners. It is because this Savior has a Father who longs to be our Father. It is because of that that we can come boldly into His presence and come as forgiven, cleansed children of God. You know, after the first service, someone said to me, you know, I really like thinking of David there as being God. I think it's the right thing to think. That God longs for all of us, yearns for us, wants no one to perish, wants no one to be walking into the darkness. Our God sent His Son so that He might die the death that was the sentence of which was on us. So that having died for us, we might live with Him. We must come and celebrate His goodness. Amen.